Okay, Book of Judges, chapter 13 and 14. The life of Samson. You know, I'll be honest with you, I still don't quite know what to make of Samson. He's always one of our favorite Bible stories. I mean, this guy, you kind of picture an Arnold Schwarzenegger, this guy who's so powerful and strong, and God uses to just smash the Philistines. And he did this under the power of God's Spirit, yet, is he the kind of man you admire? He wasn't very bright. When you look at the deal with his wife that we'll look at here in these chapters, and then how she kind of backstabbed him, he didn't learn from that, because next week we learn about how he goes to Delilah and he's stupid again. And he doesn't seem to be a very spiritual person. The only prayer I find him praying is right at the very end of his life when he asks God to give him the strength one last time so he can kill all these Philistines while he dies himself. And so there's not too much admirable about Samson, and yet I think there's a lot we can learn. We tend to admire him because of his physical fleshly strength. Yet if you look at him spiritually, there's not too much to admire. And you know, Samson is unusual because he was a Nazarite. Now, a Nazarite is not a Nazarene. A Nazarene is someone who comes from Nazareth. He didn't come from Nazareth. He's a Nazarite because he took the vow of a Nazir, which is found in Numbers chapter 6. Actually, he didn't take the vow. He was a Nazarite, but he did it without taking a vow. So let's read about it. Chapter 13. The children of Israel continued to do what was evil in the eyes of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. There was a certain man of Zorah, of the family of the Danites, and his name was Manoah. Basically the name Noah with a letter or two added in the front, or just a letter added to the front of it. Noah means rest. His wife was barren and had not given birth. Now, just based on what we've read so far, would you say Manoah was a righteous and godly man, or an unrighteous, ungodly man, just an average man, or we can't tell? What would you say? You'd probably say, I can't tell. I don't know anything about him. Doesn't tell me anything. Yet, if you have a Hebraic mindset, and you understand how the Hebrew Scriptures are constructed, there are three important hints here to tell you that Manoah was a very righteous man. Okay? First of all, it says there was a certain man. Now, there are two different words could be used there. One is Adam, Adam, which means a human being. And the other word is Ish. And he's not called an Adam. He's called an Ish. And usually that term is reserved for people who are righteous, who truly have become more than just a human being, but they're growing up into a godly image. The second hint is this. It says, and his name was Manoah. If it had said, and Manoah was his name, he would have been an unrighteous man. But because it says, and his name was Manoah, it gives us a hint that he was a righteous man. Whenever you find the formula, and his name was, and gives his name, for example, in Esther, it says, and his name was Mordecai. And Mordecai was definitely a godly, righteous man. Or in 1 Samuel 1, where it refers to Samuel's father, it says, and his name was Elkanah. He was a righteous man. But when it talks about unrighteous people, like Nabal, whose name means fool, it says, and Nabal was his name. Or Goliath, it says, and Goliath was his name. Isn't that interesting? So you can watch for that in the Scriptures. Now you might say, well, why? Why is it ordered that way? Well, one of the principles in Scripture is that a good name is to be desired before anything else. And so what they do, they'll say, and his name, Shemo, his name. That's what Shemo means. His name was, and then they give the name. So that's the second hint. And the third hint, his wife was barren. Do you ever notice how many wonderful, godly, spiritual people in the Scriptures were barren? Abraham and Sarah. And they had to go to the Lord, and finally he gave them a son. And then there's his son Isaac and his wife Rebecca, barren. had to go to the Lord. Then the Lord opens Rebekah's womb. And then there was Jacob and Rachel. Now, Leah had no problems with barrenness, but Rachel did. And finally, after much prayer, Rachel finally gives birth. And then you find, there's Elizabeth and Zechariah, John the Baptist's parents. And they were way up in years when finally an angel appeared to them and said, okay, now have a child. Of course, then you talk about real barrenness. How about a virgin getting birth? Okay? And Mary giving birth to Yeshua. So this is another hint. So we see three hints here that Manoah was a righteous man. His wife was barren and not given birth. Verse 3, and an angel of God appeared to the woman and said to her, behold now, you are barren and have not given birth, but you shall conceive and give birth to a son. And now be careful not to drink wine or aged wine, and not to eat anything contaminated, for you shall conceive and give birth to a son. A razor shall not come upon his head, for the lad shall be a Nazarite of God from the womb, and he will begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines. Notice it says he will begin. Who finally finished? David did. David brought the Philistines to a finish, but Samson started it. Now, there's some interesting things going on under the surface here. Remember I mentioned how Samson just didn't seem to be very bright? Well, that word for razor is very interesting, because when you read about the Nazarite vow back in Number 6, and you look at the common word for razor, the common word for razor is the word ta'ar, ta'ar. But that's not the word used here. The word here is morah. Now, the Hebrew students here should remember what a mora is. A mora or more, teacher. That word mora has two definitions. One is teacher, the other is razor. I mean, shouldn't a teacher be sharp? Shouldn't the teacher be able to take and separate things out and kind of dissect an issue and make it clear to you? So a razor and a teacher share the same word. Well, it's interesting that word is used here because you separate it this way. It says, and a teacher shall not come upon his head. In other words, he's thick. He doesn't learn very well. And another thing is it says a Nazarite of God. The word for God here is the word Elohim. If you go back to Number 6, the word is Yahweh, God's four-letter name. The word we use the word Adonai to express. All through Number 6, it says he'll be a Nazarite to Adonai, but here it says to Elohim. Now, if you've done any reading in Jewish studies, you know that when God's name Elohim is used, it has to do with judgment and justice. But when Adonai is used, it has to do with mercy and grace. So, why is God having Samson become a Nazarite? It's to bring grace and mercy into the world, or to bring justice and judgment against the Philistines? Definitely going to be against the Philistines. So he's called a Nazarite of Elohim. And it even says, and he will begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines. A lot of things going on there. A woman came and told her husband, saying, a man of God came to me. Now she still doesn't realize he's an angel. She thinks maybe he's a prophet or someone who just God sent along. And his appearance was like the appearance of an angel of God. Very awesome. I did not ask him where he was from, for he did not tell me his name. He said to me, behold, you shall conceive and give birth to a son, and now do not drink wine or aged wine, and do not eat anything contaminated, for the lad shall be a Nazarite unto God from the womb. And then she adds the phrase, until the day of his death. The angel didn't say that. In fact, he did not remain a Nazarite to the day of his death. His little dalliance with Delilah brought his Nazarite status to an end. But she kind of added to the words. Now, we need to understand something about the Nazarite. I'm not going to take time to read through Numbers chapter 6, but there it says, if a person wants to set himself apart, and that's what the word nazir means. It means to separate, to sever off. He wants to set himself apart to God for a period of time. Then he takes this vow. And when he takes the vow, all he has to do is shave his head or her head. All right? That's what you do to start the Nazarite vow. And then the Nazarite vow can be for a period of time. Usually it was never shorter than 30 days. But it could be 6 months, it could be a year, it could be for life. It's up to you. But when you take this vow, there are then some restrictions placed on you. First of all, you don't eat or drink anything that comes from a grapevine. Nothing that has as wine or wine vinegar or even eating grapes or raisins. Nothing from the vine enters your mouth. Second, you don't cut your hair anymore. No razor comes upon your head. Now, they may have trimmed their hair occasionally. You know, you have to do that. But as far as a razor and trimming the hair way back and making it short, no. That's a no-no. Your hair grows. And the third thing is, you don't touch anything that's dead. Now, that's not about eating a piece of chicken or a steak. It's talking about you don't touch a dead body and become ritually unclean. Even if it's your father, your mother, your sister, your brother, you don't touch them. Now, the exception of that is, if you are going somewhere and you find a dead person on the side of the road and there's no one around, in that case, you still bury that dead person and it does not violate your Nazirite vow. Because the importance of burying the dead is more important than maintaining that separation from the dead body. So those are the three things. And of course, they keep the other laws of Torah as well. But there's these three special restrictions. At the end of the time, and we read in Acts where Paul and some other men took a Nazirite vow, and then they went to the temple to end it. You'd have to go to the temple, you brought certain sacrifices, and this is what's kind of strange. You then cut your hair, you shave your head to end the vow. And you take that hair, and that also goes into the altar. What's that all about? Well, you see, the hair that grows from the time you take the vow till the time you end the vow represents your life during that period of time. It represents what your life has produced from the time you took the vow to the time you ended it. And then that is given on the altar to God. Now, can you take a Nazirite vow today? Yes, you can. Can you end a Nazirite vow today? No, you can't. Which is kind of interesting. You didn't have to have a temple to take the vow, but you had to have a temple and a sacrificial system to bring it to an end. Which brings up the question, if we are followers of Yeshua, have we to some degree or other in some way taken a Nazirite vow that is forever? It's just something to think about. It doesn't mean you can't touch dead people. It doesn't mean you can't eat raisins or drink grape juice. It doesn't mean you can't cut your hair. But in a spiritual sense, is there a Nazirite vow for us? I think yes, there is. And I think anyone who Yeshua calls to follow him, including all of us, he calls him to, he bids him come and die, as Dietrich Bonhoeffer says. In other words, it's a whole new start. All the past is shaved away, and now everything from now on is brand new, and you make yourself a living sacrifice to God from now to the end. But everything about the Nazirite vow has a spiritual aspect to it that applies to us today. Now, Samson was an exception to many of these things. First of all, he didn't take a vow. He had no choice in the matter. His mother was approached, and she was told that she wasn't to drink any wine, any grapes, and neither was he, because he's going to be a Nazirite from his mother's womb. It appears that John the Baptist and Samuel also were Nazirites from the womb, but these would be the only three in Scripture. So his Nazirite status is a little odd, a little different. So he never took the vow on himself. It was something that was imposed upon him. Which gives me a little insight into Samson's life. You know what Samson reminds me of? He reminds me of the person who inherits his faith from his parents, but he never quite chooses it for himself. You follow me? Young people here. You know, I look around, I see young people born and raised in Christian homes. And you have a faith you've inherited from your parents. That's fine while you're a child. But the day has to come where it can no longer be your parents' faith you're practicing. It must be your own. You must claim ownership of it. That's what the whole bat mitzvah and bar mitzvah service is about. You are now a son of the commandment. It's not your parents' faith anymore. You are to choose it at this point, or not. And I know too many adults who are still trying to live out their parents' faith, and it just doesn't fit. It just doesn't fit. It must become your own. You cannot piggyback on your parents' relationship with God. You must develop your own. Another difference between Samson and a regular Nazirite is that, first of all, there's no vow. It wasn't something Samson chose. It was something that was imposed upon him. And also, he says he was a Nazarite for life. Usually, it was just for a period of time, as I mentioned. And the last thing is, a Nazarite was not allowed to touch any dead carcasses, dead bodies. And yet, Samson constantly was making dead bodies. And yet, it did not violate his Nazarite status. So, there were some exceptions. Samson was a bit of an anomaly when it came to the Nazarite status. Well, let's move on here. Verse 8. Now, if I were to ask you what the next verse would be, based on what you know of other characters in the Bible, you might say, well, Manoah, when he hears about what this person told his wife, he might say, well, I want some proof. But Manoah was a righteous man. He didn't ask for proof. Look what he asked for instead. Manoah prayed to Adonai and said, please, my Lord, may the man of God whom you sent come now again to us and teach us what we should do with the lad who is to be born. He didn't ask for a sign. He didn't ask for proof that the child be born. He just accepted that he would be. But Lord, I want more information. What do I do with him? How do I raise him? Because he's going to be a special kid. God heeded the call of Manoah, and the angel of God came again to the woman when she was sitting in the field. Why do you think she was sitting in the field? Because she wanted to avoid the vineyard, is what the sages say. But Manoah, her husband, was not with her. The woman hastened. She ran and told her husband. She said to him, behold, the man who came to me that day has appeared to me. Manoah rose and went after his wife. He came to the man and said to him, are you the man who spoke to the woman? He said, I am. Manoah said, now may your words come true. What should be the conduct of the lad and his behavior? The angel of God said to Manoah, of everything that I spoke to the woman, she should beware. Notice how the angel sidesteps that question? Because he didn't have good news concerning Samson's behavior. But he simply put on them again what their responsibilities as parents were to be. Of anything that comes from the grapevine, she shall not eat. Wine or aged wine, she shall not drink. Anything contaminated, she shall not eat. Everything that I commanded her, she shall observe. Manoah said to the angel of Adonai, please let us detain you. We will prepare a goat kid for you. The angel of Adonai said to Manoah, if you detain me, I shall not eat of your food. If you wish to prepare an elevation offering, offer it up to Adonai. For Manoah did not know that he was an angel of the Lord. Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, now your translation says, what is your name, correct? It's not what it says in Hebrew. In Hebrew, normally you want to ask someone's name, you say, Ma Shemo, what is your name? Ma Shemecha, what is your name? But here it says, Mi Shemecha, who is your name? He wanted to know more than just the name tag. He wanted more than a label. He wanted to know the very essence of the person. Who is your name? Very unusual way to word it. Who is your name? Who are you? So that when your word comes about, we may honor you. The angel of the Lord said to him, why is it that you ask for my name? It is, and your translation may say, secret or hidden, right? Something like that. The word there is the word pele, pe lamed aleph. And the word normally is translated extraordinary, wonderful. Let me show you where it's first used. Go to Genesis chapter 18, verse 14. Genesis 18, 14. The very first place this word appears. Kind of interesting. It's another couple who is barren, and they receive a word from God that they will have a child. In Genesis 18, 14, remember the messengers have appeared to Abraham at the opening of the tent and told them even though Sarah's 90 years old, next year she's going to have a child. And then Sarah laughed. Verse 14, is anything too pele for the Lord, too wonderful, too extraordinary for him? That's the first place it's used. And here we find it again with Manoah and his wife, and their child is to be born. But let's go on to Isaiah chapter 9. Isaiah chapter 9. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6. Isaiah 9:6, a very well-known passage. For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders. And his name will be called Pele. Wonderful. Extraordinary. Kind of interesting, isn't it? We find this word used of Abraham and Sarah when they wanted a child, and a year later, it was prophesied they would. Find it used as Manoah's wife with the birth of Samson. But then we find out there's going to be a child born to us. A son will be given to us. The government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Pele. Wonderful, extraordinary. So maybe this angel, this messenger, was actually giving his name. Maybe it was his name. And you know, though this next verse has nothing to do with our study in Judges, verse 7, Isaiah 9:7. There will be no end to the increase of his government. There's something in the Hebrew here that's just too cool. I can't pass it up. So we're going to take a little bunny trail. And our bunny trail starts with a little Hebrew lesson. Now, if you study Hebrew at all, you understand that Hebrew has final forms. Let me explain. In English, we have 26 letters in our alphabet. And every one of those letters has two forms, lowercase and uppercase, right? So you can write a little A, a big A, a little B, a big B. And whenever a letter starts a word at the beginning of a sentence, you give it the big form. All right? Or whenever it's a proper noun, a name of a place or person, you give it its new form, the uppercase. Hebrew doesn't have uppercase and lowercase. Right? In Hebrew, in a Torah scroll, there's no punctuation. There's no uppercase, lowercase. But there are five letters that have what are called final forms. When they come at the end of a word, they change. When they're in the beginning or middle of a word, they're just normal. But when they end a word, they change form. And these contain wonderful spiritual insights. One of them is the letter Kaf. It appears this way, on the right. That's normally how it looks, like a backward letter C. Whenever it comes to the end of a word, it completely changes form. It looks like a large dalet, which means door. Kaf means a hand, a palm of a hand. It can also mean a kippah. That's where we get the word kippah. It covers. It's like a cup. That's where we get the word cup from Kaf. Okay? So when you see Kaf, you think the palm of the hand. But you know, at the end of your life, when you do works for the Lord, your works become a door. Dalet always pictures a door. In fact, the word dalet means door. Okay? So there's a lesson there. Your works, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. In other words, your good works prepare a door for people to come to the Father. Nun is another one. Nun actually means fish, but its form always represents a humble person who's bent over. But when it comes at the end, it stands straight and tall. You know, in that psalm we often read, he will straighten the bent, he supports the fallen and straightens the bent. That verse, each of those verses start with a letter of the alphabet, it goes through the whole alphabet. And that verse, it says, he will straighten the bent, he will support the fallen and straighten the bent, comes right after the letter nun, because it's bent and humble. Oh, I love this one, pay. Pay means mouth. Notice there's a closed mouth. At the end of the word, the mouth opens. In other words, keep your mouth shut till you get to the end of a matter, then talk. That's basically what it says. Zadi Zadis, or you get the word Zadik, a righteous man. And the letter Zadi, it makes a picture of a man who's kneeling with his hands up before the Lord. But what does Psalm 1 say? And the righteous will stand in the judgment. And at the end of a word, the Zadi stands up. Another picture. If you spend your life on your knees, you will stand in the judgment. But Mem is the one I really want to get at. Mem means water, and it has two forms. An open form, you can see the little opening at the bottom. And then it has a closed, sealed form. And the sages always talk about this letter as its final form being something that holds a secret. Something that is yet future. Something that's not revealed yet. And in fact, the word water, ma'im, is spelled mem, yad, mem. There's an open mem and a closed mem. You ever wonder how the creation story, you kind of think, well, these guys weren't scientists. So we talk about the waters above the firmament. Or remember, in the firmament, there's the sun, the moon, and the stars. But above the firmament are the waters above. Like, all right, we know there's no water up there. There's no water out in space. But then we have waters below. But the thing is, if we just look at water as being H2O, then no, there's no water outside, you know, light years out there. It surrounds the whole universe. But we need to look at water in a spiritual sense. Maybe what we drink and wash in as water here is just a physical picture of something that's truly spiritual. Something that's secret and concealed and hidden from our eyes, whereas this is open to us. Now the reason I go through all of this, going back to Isaiah 9:7 rather, the verse starts out not that there will be no end to the increase of his government, but it says to the increase of his government there will be no end. That first word to the increase is this one, lamorbe, lamorbe. You see something wrong with that word, lamorbe? What's wrong with it? There's a final mem, the second letter. Only place in the Bible, only place where there's a final mem inside of a word. Why did God ordain Isaiah to spell the word with a final form smack in the middle? And it's the word the increase. Increase of what? Of his government. Whose government? This child who shall be born to us, whose name is Pele, extraordinary, wonderful. This, of course, is the Messiah. So you know what the sages say? They say that his government is still sealed. It's still secret. It has not yet been opened to us. It has not yet been revealed. Don't we all long for the government of Messiah here in this earth? He came, and the Jewish people expected him to establish his government. Peace on earth. Throw out the Romans. Israel elevated. Jerusalem elevated. It's a city of God, and he rules on the throne of David forever and ever, and everyone lives happily ever after. Didn't work that way. He got nailed to the cross instead and buried in a tomb. Didn't quite have the ending that they expected. That's because the increase of his government is still a hidden and secret thing. It's still future. And someday, it'll be open to us. You get the picture? Isaiah 9:7, the only place where a final mem is found. Go ahead, Ken.
Would also be a verse somewhere that we haven't found
that would open? I wish. It may be there, but I haven't seen it yet. But I think it's going to be soon. Now, someone else shared with me, and I haven't verified it yet, but I do find where this is actually recorded somewhere. I'll share it with you. But he said that he's read where some of the rabbis say that this closed mem represents the womb from which Messiah will be born. And so it's closed up because they're still looking for his return. Well, they're looking for him to come the first time. So I don't know. I don't know. But the other part I can verify for you for sure. Well, let's move on. We're not moving very quickly with Samson, are we? Okay. Verse 19. Back to Judges chapter 13. Verse 19. Manoah took the goat kid and the meal offering and brought them up on the rock to Adonai, and the angel performed a, guess what that word is there? It's the word Pele again. He worked a wonder, an extraordinary, a marvelous thing. As Manoah and his wife watched, it happened that as the flame rose up from atop the altar to the heavens, the angel of Adonai went up in the flame of the altar. Manoah and his wife were watching, and they fell upon their faces to the ground. Here's the principle of the altar. You want to understand what the altar is all about, what being a living sacrifice is all about. Here's a picture of it. The only way to approach God is through the fire. That's how you go up. When you do a sacrifice, it's called an olah, because the word Hebrew word olah means to go up. When you burn something, it goes up. We are to be living sacrifices, and the only way to really come into intimate relationship with God is by laying down your own life. That's why Yeshua says, if any man will come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, which is an execution stake, daily, and follow me. Paul beseeches us to be living sacrifices, holy, acceptable unto God. We need to get past the fire brimstone kind of preaching we've heard, because we grew up with this idea that fire is demonic and devilish and hellish. I don't find that in Scripture. Every place I've ever seen the word fire in Scripture, it has to do with God's holiness, God's presence. God reveals himself to Moses through a burning bush. At the Garden of Eden, he puts a flaming sword. He picks up Elijah in a chariot of fire. And you know, it talks about the seraphim, the burning ones, in God's presence. It even says our God is a consuming fire. And so the fire of the altar was the element in which the angel, he just came into God's presence. When he went into the fire, he's before God. You see, the reason we don't care for fire is because to flesh, fire is not very comfortable. Mm-hmm. We derive benefit from fire as long as we maintain a proper distance. We can enjoy its heat and its light. But you get too close, it's very uncomfortable. We're mesmerized and attracted to it, but there's a certain point we cannot cross the line or it damages us, our flesh, that is. You follow me? The same thing is true of God. As fallen creatures in bodies of flesh, it's just like with Moses. God appears in the burning bush, and Moses gets closer and closer and closer, and finally God says, stop. Take your shoes off. Don't come any closer. If he'd been further away, he wouldn't have been close enough to God. Any closer, it would have been presumptuous, it would have crossed the line, and it would have been displeasing to God. Until someday we have spiritual bodies, there's a certain distance we maintain. Now you may think, well, that sounds really odd. Well, think of a marriage. When you're engaged, and right now the Bible compares us to a betrothal period between Messiah and his bride. During the engagement period, physically, what's the relationship between the man and the woman? They're close together as much as they can be, but there's a certain closeness they do not cross. That's the relationship with God in us. That guy and girl will kiss and hold hands and gaze into one another's eyes, but there's a line they do not cross until the wedding day. We are in that same position with God. We hunger and thirst to be close to him, and we look to the honeymoon period. And we can draw close to him. We're to seek his face and look into his eyes every chance we get. But there's something better coming. But there's a danger when some people insist on crossing the line now. And it's hard to put into words, but I think we've all met people who are a little too spiritual for their own good. They want to get so close to God, they want to be more spiritual than anybody else, and as a result, they just turn weird. They just get weird because they can't get closer than God allows. But they insist on getting closer, and there's a twisting that takes place in their spirits and in their minds. And instead of being attractive spiritually, they now become, I don't like what I see there. But then we start getting confused, like, well, is that the way I'm supposed to be? Because they seem so spiritual, yet I don't like what I see, but is that what I'm supposed to be? God, help me. I'm confused. And these people do cause confusion. Have you met people? You kind of know what I'm talking about. All right. So anyways, I love this, where they see the angel go up to heaven. And what do Manoah and his wife do? They fall on their face into the ground. Oh, someday when we have spiritual bodies and the flame is not a threat to us, it becomes our element. Because we're so absolutely pure, it causes no pain, discomfort to the flesh. Now, I know we always hear about hellfire, and the Bible does talk about the fires of hell. But it makes me wonder. I'm just thinking out loud. Don't run with this and throw stones at me. I'm just imagining, okay? Could it possibly be that heaven and hell are not necessarily separate locations? They're just two different experiences of the same one? Just fine. You know, in spiritual terms, in spiritual dynamics, they're completely different from physical dynamics. So it's a way to think. It's just a way to think. I know for some people, for me to do what some people say is fun, to me would be hell. And for them to spend the time here and listen to me yak for an hour would be hell for them. So it depends on where you're at. You know what I'm saying? All right.
Hey, Grant.
Yes, sir.
You talk a lot about T.S. Lewis, mm-hmm. and you talk about the Great Divorce. When the shadows visited up to heaven, mm-hmm. stepping on the grass was worse than hell.
Yes.
They wanted to go back.
Right. Yeah. Wonderful book. If you haven't read The Great Divorce, read it. If you've read it, read it again. I know someone who reads it once a year, every year. It's an incredible, short little book. Wonderful book. Jim, I think you had your hand up first.
In your earlier mention of Samson, he questioned God when he was captured to be placed by a pillar and given the strength enough to mm-hmm. destroy the temple and kill that many more Philistines with his last act. Mm-hmm. Was it his faith clear to the end or the desired death of all the Philistines that prompted, I said the word I know, but
yeah.
allowed God to answer a request for him to commit suicide?
That's a good question. I'm not quite sure. We'll look at that next week when he comes to his death. I'm going to think about it more this week, and we all can. But when you mentioned his faith, I don't see faithfulness in Samson. I just don't see it.
Well, he must have thought God was still capable of miraculous
things. Right at the end, I think right there at his death, I think he got it. I think he got it at that point in time. And God accomplished more in his death than he ever did through his life. Yeah. I think Samson was people that right at the very end, even though his eyes had been gouged out, he finally for the first time saw. But we'll, that's just me surmising. I don't know. Well, let's move on a bit more. We have a lot of judges to go and not much time. Oh, Phil, you had your hand up. Do you want to, I didn't mean to skip you.
You know, talking about fire is when you think how nature, fire has such an amazing purpose, like you said, you know, that you can't get too close, but at the same time, look at all that it does when we use it properly.
Yes.
You know, how we're able to create great things in a forge.
Mm-hmm.
I know Rich was sharing some of the stuff that he was doing, but
yeah.
how amazing is what you can create with proper heat.
Absolutely.
Of any material, metal or clay, how it refines it and it
yes.
removes impurity. And it always makes you think when you're talking about, say, to those who sought purity, heaven is
mm-hmm.
because the fire affects you in a different way because you have not spent your life working on ensuring your life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, and because of that, fire actually affects you in a different way. It causes you pain.
Yes.
And anytime we approach things that are, when we're in sin, holiness makes us run away. We're in darkness.
We're in agony when we're, we're around people who are holy. Yeah, right.
So, you know, it's just it's an amazing principle to see how it can build around nature. And you know that there's obviously amazing spiritual principles to that.
Yes.
Of how God
absolutely.
In our lives.
Very true. Yeah, it's fun to go back and kind of rethink things, and we're not the same as we were in children when sometimes these things were being embedded in our minds about fire and this and that. And so as adults, you go back and rethink things, and they feel a little clearer, hopefully a little clearer. Well, anyways, we're going to move on. Well, let's just go right on down to verse 24. The woman gave birth to a son. She called his name Shimshon. That's how it's pronounced in Hebrew. Comes from the root Shemesh or Shamash. Shen Mem Shem. Shen Mem Shem. And if it's pronounced Shemesh, it means the sun, S-U-N. If it's pronounced Shamash, it means a servant. So I don't know if he's being called a little sun, a little S-U-N, a little bright light, or a small servant, or maybe both. But that's the root of the name. The lad grew, and Adonai blessed him. And this next phrase is interesting. The Spirit of the Lord began to beat in him, or resound in him. The imagery is that of a clapper inside of a bell. You know, we see bells, say, oh, look at that great, that wonderful bell. But without that clapper hidden inside, the bell is a dumb bell, okay? It makes no sound. It's that hidden thing within, beating within, that gives the bell that beautiful sound. And so here's talking about the Holy Spirit almost as like being a clapper inside of Samson's life, inside of his soul, and began to resonate in him. You know what? Can you identify with those words? I know I can. There are times when the Holy Spirit just kind of, it's not a comfortable thing, but he begins to move. And you know, you can either kind of shut down and try to remove the clapper, or it's going to come out. And you have to follow through and do the things God's just kind of stressing you out to do. But that's what was happening with Samson. Chapter 14. Samson went down to Timnah. Now, the people who during this day were intimately familiar with Torah would immediately think back to Genesis 38, where it says Judah went up to Timnah. You know the story about Judah in Genesis 38? Joseph has been sold into Egypt, and then God sticks this one chapter. It doesn't belong in the story at all, it doesn't seem. He sticks Genesis 38 in there, where Judah is going up to Timnah, and he sees a prostitute at the corner. Does not recognize that she's actually his daughter-in-law, that he has wronged because he has not provided his son to her. And so he has relations with her, and for payment she asks for his staff and his cloak and his ring. And until he can send the payment, she takes this as security. While he goes to send payment, she can't be found. Months later, it's found out that Tamar, your daughter-in-law, she's pregnant. He's ready to have her stoned. And she comes forth, and she says, I've been made pregnant by the man to whom these belong, and holds up his staff, his signet, and his cloak. And Judah repents. He says, she's more righteous than me. And from that child, actually twins she had, from one of those children, the Messiah descended. So here we see with Judah, he went up to Timnah, had relations with a woman, and from her issued the Messiah generations later. But he was deceived by who she was. His heart wasn't right. He was just acting out of lust, but God used it to provide the Messiah. But here we see Samson going down to Timnah. Nothing good comes out of this. And so what the writer is wanting us to do is to contrast Judah and Samson at this point. I wish we had time to do that. You can do that for homework. He saw a woman of the daughters of the Philistines. He went up, told his father and mother, said, I have seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines, now take her for me as a wife. Now at this time, it's very unusual for a man to marry outside of his tribe. So, but marry outside of Judaism, in fact a Philistine who's the enemy, unheard of. His father and mother said to him, is there no woman among the daughters of your brothers, in other words, of the tribe of Dan, and in all my people, in fact in all of Israel, any tribe, that you have to go take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines? But Samson said to his father, take her from me, for she is fitting in my eyes. How do you think Samson's mother felt? He's probably a teenager at this time. I mean, think about it. She's had two visitations from an angel. She was miraculously delivered from being barren. Not only that, but she's told that even before the child's birth, don't you eat anything from the grapevine or anything impure, because your child's going to be a Nazarite for life. And God's going to use him in a powerful way to deliver Israel from the Philistines. And now he's going down to marry one. How would you feel as the mother? I mentioned her more than Manoah because moms feel pain of their children, I think even more than dads do. And it was to her the angel appeared the first time. She's the one who had invested so much in this child while she was carrying him. How do you think she felt? Where's God in all of this? God's going around. Everything's a bust. What did I do wrong? I'm sure she's beating herself up. Where did I go wrong? I didn't raise this holy child, and now everything's gone belly up. Everything's hopeless. Yeah, Mike.
Here's a guy that you aimed your life with, checking how many times he's in there, that the angel appeared and was there with him. Here's in the next chapter, it's all turned about of somebody that they prayed for. Where's the child? The angel was involved with everything.
Yeah.
Then the angel of God, and here's somebody, they went altogether different then.
Yeah.
Outside of everything, what he's supposed to do.
Yeah. Samson is not an example of a righteous, godly man. But, yeah. Well, one. Well, our tape just went out too. Oh, well. Okay, I'm not sure, quite sure what happened there. But, my goodness. Circuit breaker just slipped there, Dale. Well, it has to be one of those top five. Unless it's the main. Oh, well, we're not going to worry about it.
They have a bunch of fans running.
It did flood. That's why. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's probably a main breaker downstairs or something. Oh, well. We're not going to let it stop us. Yeah. Okay. Not going to worry about it. No problem. Anyways, back to Samson. And we want to finish up here soon. So anyways, they go down to Timnah, and you know the encounter Samson has with the lion. Kills the lion, just kills it. Says the Spirit of God came on him, and he kills this lion with his bare hands, throws the body off in the weeds, keeps on going. He goes down and makes some arrangements with the woman. Then his father and Samson go down another time to prepare the feast for the marriage. And then Samson puts forth the riddle. And the riddle is in verse 14. There are 30 companions, 30 Philistines that come there to party with Samson and with the families. So Samson says, listen, I got a riddle. You answer the riddle, you buy me 30 sheets and 30 changes of clothing. Now remember, back in this time, a change of clothing was about a year's wages. Samson says, if you guess the riddle, then I'll buy each of you a change of clothing and a sheet. He said, okay, what's the riddle? Verse 14, he said to them, from the eater came forth food, from the strong came forth sweetness. What he's referring to here is that lion he killed, and you know the story. When he passed by the lion later, inside there was a bee's nest, honeybees, and he reached inside, scraped out honey out of the carcass of this lion, which would mean he was eating something unclean, something that came from a carcass, something a Nazirite is not supposed to do. Well, they couldn't guess the riddle, so they go to Samson's fiance and says, you either find out from him the answer to the riddle, or we will burn you, your father's, and your house in fire. So she goes and weeps and moans and everything, and so finally the last day, Samson's worn down, this big strong man, worn down by a woman's tears, and he tells her the answer. She goes and tells her Philistine buddies, and they guess it, and it makes Samson mad. In fact, he storms out before the marriage is even complete. And he goes way off to a distant town, kills 30 Philistines, takes their clothes, and brings those back and gives them. Now, what's interesting here is that, and we skip the verse, but it says that even God was in this. Even God was in this whole thing that was going on. How was God in this?
Well,
Well, here's the thing. By Samson making a personal thing between him and the Philistines, Israel's not drawn into a war. Everything you read about Samson is just him alone against all the Philistines. Just him by himself. And Israel's protected from being drawn into a long, drawn-out war with the Philistines. And it starts here with Samson's thick-headedness, his lust, his lack of wisdom, and going down to marry this Philistine woman. And then later, when he finally decides to go see her and say, okay, I'm going to go ahead and claim her since we did have the ceremony and everything, finds out she's been given to another man. Then he goes off and kills 300 Philistines out of her rage. Everything that God accomplished through Samson was when Samson was just mad and angry and acting out of his own human ways. God used Samson in spite of himself. There's some observations here. We'll close with this. So there's some observations. Okay, squint. They'll show up. You just squint. Okay, we're not going to worry about the overhead then. But you can listen to these or write them down. Samson hated the Philistines, didn't he? He hated them. And he grew to hate them more, and the more he hated them, the more he killed of them. But hatred of sin does not equal love for God. Remember that. Do you ever meet believers that hate sin with a passion? And they think that is love for God. And it's not, folks. I have news for you. Hatred for sin does not equal love for God. Ignore that man behind the curtain. Hatred of sin does not equal love for God. If only Samson had loved God as well as hating Philistines. Second, elevated spiritual status is no substitute for wisdom. Samson had an elevated spiritual status. He's a Nazarite from his womb. Had no choice in the matter. Born to righteous parents. But was he wise? He never grew up. He never grew up and got to know God on his own. Even the Holy Spirit operated through him. He never became a man of wisdom. He became a man of just reaction. Yes, Phil.
How God hints the end.
Mm-hmm.
Because Samson's very fleshly individual. It's all about him. I mean, he's certainly not using any direction from God.
Not really.
In his own purpose.
Right.
God uses the tool, and what the tool does, so he owns situations with others and carves out this situation to protect the Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
But he also does the same thing with the enemy.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in a spiritual sense, it's like, I look at Samson, I can look at, that's almost like a physical form of the flesh, desire, emotion, strength, power. He has everything that at least the worldly man wants, except he doesn't have the brains.
Right.
And he doesn't have spirit behind it to do what is right. And so he does whatever he wants. No man can control him.
Yeah.
Except God.
See, I think you put your finger on what the story of Samson is there to teach us. You know, to see Samson, he appeared to have everything a man could possibly want to be. He's strong, he's big, he's got great hair, and you know, and you know, he's a hero. He's a national hero of Israel. So in man's eyes, he's everything a guy could possibly want to be. But in God's eyes, I don't think he measured up to much. And I think that's the lesson here. And I just brought up some of these other observations, but I think Phil put your finger on it. Another observation, even our shortcomings are used by God, but that is no excuse. Even our shortcomings are used by God, but that's not an excuse. Two more. And this is very important. The presence of God's Spirit for victory may not be a sign of God's pleasure in our lives. God's presence, the presence of God's Spirit for victory may not be a sign of God's pleasure in your life. And I think we need to be very careful when we start chalking up spiritual victories. Yeah, God could be using you. But God uses everything. Thing is God pleased with you? That's the question. That is the question. And the last one. This experience where Samson killed the lion. He was going down, it says, through the vineyard. He wasn't supposed to be eating grapes, but he's going through the vineyard and the lion attacked. But God, it says the Spirit of God came on him, he just ripped it apart like a lamb. And then he put the carcass over there, but he didn't tell his mom and dad about it, didn't tell his new bride about it. He kept it totally secret between him and the Lord. The thing to say, this was a deep spiritual experience in Samson's life. That's why he kept it to himself. Until he decided to use it for a frivolous use as a riddle. And then that blew up in his face. It cost him this beautiful woman he wanted to marry. Cost the lives of 30 Philistines. And then later, his wife and the family are all burned in a fire. It caused embarrassment, caused shame. Because he goes down to Timnah to marry this woman and bring her home, he goes back home empty-handed. Okay? Because she made a fool of him. It all blew up in his face. We need to be very careful of taking spiritual experiences, and there, God will bring spiritual experiences to our life, but then to take them and use them for something frivolous and silly talk and light talk and use them in wrong ways. I think Samson, if he had kept that experience to himself and learned from it, his life would take a different course. But he used it for something foolish. God still used the experience. God still used his wrong actions. But remember, God using you does not mean God's pleased with you. And that's a lesson we just don't hear. But it's absolutely true. God used Judas. I don't think God was pleased with Judas. God used Pharaoh. In fact, God says, I raised you up for this purpose so I could display my power in you. I don't think God was pleased with Pharaoh. So God uses you? Whoop-de-doo. Is God pleased with you? That's the question. And God's pleased with us when we love him and we surrender our hearts to him and we obey his word. That's what God wants. Samson didn't have that. This big, strong man. He looked great on the outside, but in his heart, he was a weakling. He was a little 90-pound weakling inside. So I thank the lessons for us. Well, anyways, let's close in prayer. Unless there's a final question or comment. Yes, Ken or April, either one.
I didn't know if I heard you say that Samson said the Spirit came on him.
The Bible says the Spirit of God came upon him. Mm-hmm.
I thought I heard you say Samson.
Oh, if I did, I misspoke then.
No, I just heard it. Yeah. Probably just, I understand that coming through the vineyard. Well, he's not supposed to be. He's already breaking vows and the Spirit's still coming upon him. And I don't get that.
God's purpose is still going to be accomplished. It's another lesson. We could add this another observation. God's will be done. You can cooperate or not, but it will be done. Who can thwart his will, Job asks. Or he says, no one can thwart his will. And Paul asks, who can resist his will? It can't be done. It eventually be done. Yes, Shelley.
You were mentioning when the angel was saying the names, you know, being mysterious or unknowable.
Yes.
And the translation that I have when you go over into Isaiah 9 for Jonah.
Yes.
It says, the mighty God is planning grace, the eternal father of peaceable rulers.
Yeah, I think they're using the word, translated the word mighty there. That would be the word that translates pele. It's an adjective. Yeah. Yes. Yes, planning grace. Neat. That's neat. Yes. And April will give you the last word.
You know the song you sing, we choose the fear of the Lord, and the fear of the Lord is to hate all evil.
Mm-hmm.
That can't be equivalent to God then, that's the love of God.
No.
Because, okay, so fear and love.
Do different things.
Standing
in awe. Mm-hmm. Noah, you often open prayer with Malkino, Avinu Malkino, our Father, our King. A father is to be loved. A king is to be feared. Okay? In fact, as my father, I could love him, but I could also fear him when I did something wrong. It's kind of an interesting conundrum there. But with God, are we to fear him? Yes. Are we to love him? Absolutely. Can you fear him without loving him? Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the demons quake in their boots, right? That's what it tells us. And but we know that perfect love casts out fear. I think the day comes when our fear of God is completely eclipsed by our love for him. And our love for him will grow to perfection so that the idea of disobeying him or displeasing him in any way doesn't even enter our minds. It's an impossibility. So that's what we should do, is grow up in our love for him. So the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. Not the end of it, but the beginning. It's a starting point. But it should be replaced and grow into and evolve into love for him. Does that make sense? Okay. Well, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for this time together. And I pray, Lord, that nothing I've said would in any way detract from the name of Samson. For, Lord, I know I'm going to spend eternity with him. And I don't want to say anything about him now that would be derogatory. But, Lord, I want my words to be true. And I pray that Samson's glory and blessing and reward be the fact that he provides an example for us that we can wisely apply to our lives. And so we can learn from his mistakes. So, Lord, even now, Samson is still being used by you. Lord, help us to be wise. Help us to be victorious in the battles we fight. And help us not, as Samson did, to always rely upon the weapons of the flesh, but instead, Lord, to take up our spiritual weapons, because our enemy is spiritual. So may we take these lessons, learn them, and apply them wisely for your glory and for the furtherance of your kingdom. We ask in Yeshua's name. Amen.